This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to the Wheelhouse.
You can see the confidence build day by day, and there is an electricity to his personality on the field that's really hard to look away from.
Starring Jerry DePoto.
And Jerry DePoto to the plate with a 2-2 pitch to Alex. Swing and a miss. He struck him out on the fastball.
With Aaron Goldsmith.
And now chapter three is, he's a real ball player. He's an impactful player. He can do a ton for your team, and this is a guy that can really help to solidify a big league lineup.
And Gary Hill Jr.
He seems along those lines where he wants to be great and does everything possible to go get it.
It's time for the Wheelhouse. Here's Aaron.
Welcome to another simulcast edition of the Wheelhouse podcast. My name is Aaron Goldsmith, one of the Mariners broadcasters. And if you're new to the program, well, we go about twice a month with the Mariners general manager, Jerry DePoto. We go for close to an hour. So with that in mind, Jerry, it's great to be with you as always.
It is a joy, as it sometimes can be.
We are also joined by the one and only Gary Hill. G-Man, good to be with you also.
It's great to be here.
Well, Jerry, man, the season is in full swing. The winning month of April is behind the Mariners, so there were a lot of good takeaways there. The second month of the season has not been as productive. You've been hit by injuries. You've been hit by a COVID outbreak in the bullpen as well. You've seen some good pitching. What has been the overall takeaway from the second month of the season?
Can't wait until we get to the third month of the season is my takeaway. It's been a rough month of May, you know, from just a general lack of offense, as you said, running into some really good pitching along the way, and then battling the injury bug. You know, here as we enter the last week of May, we're looking at closing in on 20 players on our injured list. And it's hard to operate that way when you're missing so many key guys, and especially what we're trying to navigate through at the end of games right now with our bullpen. That's going to be a challenge, at least for the short-term future. And hopefully once we're back to 100%, maybe we can pull out of this and start playing like we were in April.
We've seen some really exciting moments this month. Nevertheless, we've seen two debuts that we've been waiting years at this point to see, and the time has come. Let's touch on Logan Gilbert first. A handful of starts for Logan in his young major league career. What have been your takeaways?
That he is as mature as we thought he would be when we promoted him. And, you know, Logan's ready for this challenge. He thinks through the game. He's prepared for each one of his opponents. When we did inform him that he was coming to the big leagues for the first time, we let him know 3 or 4 days in advance so that he could prepare for his first outing against the Indians and, you know, give him a chance to strategize on the way he wanted to go about it. And we think that was the right way to go. I love what he's doing with his fastball. You know, he's hammering the strike zone with his fastball. And when you really start to see Logan click, you'll see that fastball start to elevate a little bit more. And he needs to start doing a more consistent job of landing his secondaries. And once those things happen, you'll see what we've always watched from Logan Gilbert, which is dominance of the strike zone and really utilizing his best assets, which are fastball elevation and ride and the ability to locate his secondary pitches.
What's been your initial takeaways from our first look at Kelnick?
Yeah, I mean, Jared's right where a young hitter would be. I think this Oakland series that we're just coming out of is really reflective of the adjustments that young players will make quickly. You know, he had a wonderful second day in the big leagues where I think we saw how electric he can be, put a good swing on a ball and hit a homer, a couple of hustle doubles, really changed the energy of the game. And then he went through about a week-long lull. And, you know, and what we saw in Oakland was just a series of good swings. And, you know, we saw the long home run. We saw a really good, I think, 8-pitch walk leading off the first game of that series. And the result of all of that is we are as encouraged as we've ever been that this should be a relatively quick transition to the big leagues for JK. He's a really adept hitter. He knows himself, and he's making the adjustments that are required at this level.
It was interesting hearing Jared talk to the media the other day, and he was saying how he feels like he's been pitched really tough on the edges, pitcher's pitches. And when that was said, I can understand why he feels that way, certainly. But I think this next question is, well, is that happening because he's Jared Kelnick, or is that happening because he's facing major league pitching for the first time and there just aren't as many meatballs and center cut fastballs here as compared to in the minors?
I think it's door two. that's the way it is in the big leagues. And I will say, especially during the month of May, and I've made this observation before, you could be Jared Kelnick, you could be Mitch Haniger, you could be Dylan Moore or Evan White. A lot of our guys had been pitched very, very tough during the month of May. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of edge pitches, and we don't swing collectively at a lot of edge pitches. And as a result, we're in a lot of 0-2 and 1-2 counts pretty quickly. And that makes it really hard to come back in at-bats. But, to Jared's credit, he's identifying it pretty quickly, and he's swinging at the right pitches. His process is good, and I think you're going to start seeing results in a windfall.
It does strike me, not just with Jared, with any young hitter coming up for the first time, thinking about what they're seeing for the first time, and not that they haven't seen velocity or not that they haven't seen really good pitchers along the way, but like the perfect combo of velocity and command, and they're seeing it every single day and the adjustments they have to make along the way. That's got to be really tough, especially at the beginning stages.
You know, we've talked about that with Jared and others that are coming through our minor league system. You know, this is a time we're dealing with unprecedented times in baseball where you're getting that type of velocity night after night. And the trick in the big leagues is that when you are ahead in the count as a hitter and you're 2-0, 2-1, and 3-1, you're not getting the 97-mile-an-hour heater. You're probably getting the above-average breaking ball. And that's what makes this all the more difficult, is that while you have to really gear up to hit that kind of velocity, you also have to be aware and protective of the fact that in those counts where in the minor leagues you could just tee off on a fastball, that's not coming. You know, the best hitters in the world, and these are the best hitters in the world, they can hit a 97-mile-an-hour fastball with some routine. It's when they're disrupted, their timing is disrupted by changeups, by those behind in the count breaking balls. That is what makes hitting the most difficult thing to do in sports, Ted Williams once said.
Getting back to Logan for a minute, it's clear that the fastball is his pitch. He loves his fastball, and he's used it a lot early on. But it's been interesting to see the slider, especially with two strikes. We saw that kind of second time through the order in his debut. It's been a good strikeout pitch. He has the curveball as well. As you see those two pitches develop, do you think the slider will be that go-to two-strike pitch? Will it be the curveball? Could it be either or? How do you see that going forward for him?
Well, you know, with Logan, it's either one on a given night. You know, he has a good curveball. He has a good slider. The slider is, from an efficiency standpoint, the more consistent of the two. They're both swing and miss pitches for him. You know, and what we haven't seen yet is that Logan does have a really good changeup. He just doesn't throw it a great deal. Some of that is because he's been through, you know, the minor league development where you're just not pressed enough to have to use it that much. You're doing the favor to the hitter by throwing it in some cases. And here, as he gets further into his big league career, I think you'll start to see that play out. But on a given night, it could be his curveball. It could be his slider. You know, right now, I'd lean more toward the slider. But the big, you know, difference maker impact pitch for Logan is just his fastball and the many different things he can do with it. Because he can make it look like a lot of different pitches. And it's in addition to being at a very high velocity.
Is that a rare thing now for a debuting pitcher for us to be talking about his fastball? I mean, we are in the era of velocity, and yet more talk than ever is on the breaking ball, whether it's a curve or a slider. And we've established he has those two, but to see a young pitcher like his fastball and have it be so efficient and effective, it seems like that isn't something that we see as often now as 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah, especially not if it wasn't the acclaimed 100-mile-an-hour, you know, Texas schoolboy legend. You know, this is not that. This is, you know, Logan throws 93 to 98. You know, he's going to average around 94 or 94 and change most nights. But the fastball has an effective velocity that is much greater than that. You know, the extension that he gets coming down the hill Logan's 6'6", 6'7", you know, and it's a lot of arms and legs coming at you. And when he gets down that hill, and he's coming down in a fury, I mean, he's letting it go. and when he's throwing 97 miles an hour and he's letting it go at much closer to the hitter, at least, you know, it's perceived as such, and it makes that 97 feel like it's 107. And, you know, and now on the day where he's landing that curveball or he's choosing to use the changeup as a separator, now the fastball might look like 120. It's I don't want to compare it to the greatest fastballs that we've seen, but those tall, whippy pitchers that, you know, in history, Randy Johnson being maybe the most prominent, it's that they have dominant fastballs when they are throwing strikes because it's right on the hitter. And Logan has a little bit of that quality.
Is there a way to measure the effective velocity or perceived velocity of a fastball, or is it just dudes in the dugout talking about how quickly it gets on you?
Oh, no, I think there is a way. You know, I'm not smart enough to do that, but I know people who are smart enough to do that. And we have, you know, we have a grading system that we use that tries to capture that. And Logan's fastball ranks particularly high on that grading scale when you take all of the factors into consideration: the velocity, the horizontal or vertical break to the pitch, you know, the ride that it gets through the zone, and then in his case, the proximity with which he's releasing it. We can capture his extension level. And I want to say at one point in 2019, when Logan was pitching in AA, we had surmised that he had the second longest, stride down the mound, that there was less room for the hitter to react when Logan was throwing to anybody but one other pitcher in the game. I don't recall who that was, but Logan was, he was that high in that scale of measure.
So he'll strike you out and then shake your hand right after.
Correct.
Which is nice.
Or slap you in the face. One or the other.
It has been a blast watching Yusei Kikuchi. I mean, his last five starts in particular, I'm imagining this is along the lines of what you were really having in mind when you first brought Yusei over to the Mariners and to the U.S. His velocity has ticked up since his original days as a Mariner, but he has been just purely dominant by and large. What have been your biggest takeaways from, let's call it, the last five starts from Yusei Kikuchi?
You know, I could even say just the last 2.5 years of Yusei Kikuchi, but these last five starts, I feel like we are seeing, it's the combination of power and precision and knowing who he is. It's a confidence that Yusei has that wasn't always evident in 2019. It would come and go a little bit in 2020. It has been there throughout, you know, since really the first day of spring training in 2021. And we are seeing the precision that he showed us in 2019 when I thought he was an exceptionally good strike thrower for most of that season. And we are seeing it combined with the kind of stuff, if not even a little better, than what we saw in 2020. And, you know, that adds up to someone who I think has a stake to being an all-star level pitcher in this game. It's the ability to strike people out. He has done a better job of corralling the walks. And the biggest thing for Yusei is getting away from that big inning, the crooked number, that unmanageable inning that happened to him so often in his first year and a half, that it's just not happening. And that's when you go from being a competitive major league starter to being, you know, the guys who drive starting rotations, you know, those first 2-3 pitchers in a rotation that really drive good teams. And he's become one of those.
I'm curious. We talked about it a lot last year where he pitched better than his surface numbers. You look under the hood, he was doing a lot of things well. What we're seeing this year, how much of it is the numbers are catching up to that, and how much is it he's taken really the next step forward?
You know, I think, and I hit on it with one of those three factors being confidence. That, I think, is the biggest thing for Yusei, as it is for most, you know, players in this league. But I think he took the physical stuff and the jumps that he made in 2020 and really embraced how to go about it. And it happened in a backfield game in spring training, if being, you know, accurate to the moment, where we were over playing a B game late in the spring against the Cleveland Indians, and we were back into that same, you know, Yusei inning that sometimes it would be that 25-30 pitch inning where you're getting a lot of pitches that are nasty, they're just missing, and now you're in, you know, 3-1 and 3-2 counts, using up a lot of pitch count and sometimes creating some traffic. And, you know, and he took on almost a new persona. He just started, you know, he started outwardly showing his aggression in a way that he never really had. And you can see it in Yusei's face now when he pitches. He gets a very intense, like, game face look, you know, and you'll see him exhale, and he just gets after it. And now you're going to see, like we did in Oakland, you're going to see 97s and 98s. And it's not an occasional 97 or 98. That's his fastball. He's throwing 95 to 98. He's got a cutter that's in that 92, 93 range, and he throws it a lot. I think we've seen a drastic step forward with his changeup. He's just so confident in all of his pitches, and he can throw any of them at any time. And when you have those kinds of weapons and that type of confidence, you get the results that he's been getting lately.
It's hard to think of a pitcher at his age who has come into camp in consecutive years with big uptick in stuff, right? Like, normally, we saw Justin Dunn do that this spring training. He's a young guy. But for Yusei, who's an established professional pitcher, not as much in the major leagues, but in the pro ranks going back to his days in Japan, it's hard to find a comp on a guy who's been able to do what he has done in those regards. Is this just him getting after it like hardly anybody else each winter? We know he spent some time at Driveline and know he's really into the analytics, but is this Yusei just digging in deep every winter?
Yes, in a word. I would also say that this is more what Yusei had been in Japan. You know, this is the version of Yusei that the NPB got to see more consistently than we have. He always had these big weapons. And, you know, the anomaly being the 2019 season, where he came over and the weapons weren't blow you away. They were good, not what we're seeing right now. And I do think that there is some of that. There was Yusei trying to figure out the major league game. And, you know, it's having to be a little bit quicker. At the time, it was pitching in a five-man rotation rather than a six-man rotation. You know, at the time, it was pitching with left-handers or even a starting rotation around him that were very centered on throwing strikes and changing speeds, which was never Yusei's, you know, forte or MO. He went out and he was power. And, you know, to that extent, maybe a little bit more like vintage James Paxton than it was about Marco and Wade LeBlanc and Mike Leake. You know, those were his rotation mates at the time. And that was, he was watching them for guidance on how to manage major league lineups, which was, hey, in and out, back and forth. And so Yusei is going out and he's trying to pitch like pitchers that have a different repertoire or skill set than he does. And he's very, very outgoing in seeking more information to manage. And he's seeking it from players who had a very different skill set. And that's not a fault to any of them for providing him with, I guess, some insights into what they had to do to succeed in this league. But it might not have been relevant to Yusei's journey. And I, in 2020, he came into spring training. He just got away from that. And he started doing Yusei Kikuchi again. And that's what we're seeing now. It's just the maybe the best version of that we've seen.
And along those lines, even though we are seeing the power stuff, Scott even said the other day that for him, if you look at the whole team this year and kind of surprising pleasant developments, it's been Yusei's changeup. I mean, that's a pitch that he has in certain starts leaned on and has been really effective.
And it's weird to say this about a changeup. It's a power changeup. It's a dive bomber. And, you know, that's not a common thing. I would say the same thing about, you know, Felix Hernandez changeup and it was a power changeup that's just a diver. I would say that about Yu Darvish's changeup. You know, there are changeups that change that provide a back and forth, almost rocking chair movement. And then there are changeups that just dive out of the zone and it's a swing and miss pitch. That's what we've seen from the best version of Yusei's changeup, is that it has that diving quality. And it's less so about neutralizing a bat speed and more about creating a different action for that hitter to need to be concerned with. And it's been awesome. You know, and when he's at his best, I thought he had a terrific changeup in his outing in Houston, for instance, where I'm not sure you can throw changeups better than he was throwing them. And this is a year removed from Yusei really having to be begged to throw a changeup. You know, it was really not a part of the repertoire. And then I think at his height this year, he's thrown 16 changeups in an outing, which is remarkable, and how far he's come in his trust in that pitch.
I've always felt like the power changeup, you know, the one we're seeing from Yusei and the Felix, it needs a different name because changeup just doesn't quite capture what we're looking at.
It seems to me that this is a layup for you. You know, lying awake at night, staring at the ceiling, think of what to name the power changeup.
Are you listening to Blowers and Me too often or something? And Blow just ridiculing me for my after-hours baseball conversations?
With yourself, yeah.
Yeah, that's you could have left that part out. we'll put our best people on it. Gary and I specialize in semi-worthless baseball conversations. Highly.
Yeah.
Although Jerry's in our wheelhouse.
Yeah, that's
man.
True.
He's one of ours. You know,
Did you say in the wheelhouse?
I did. Nice. Very on brand. Thank you. Thank you for noticing that. Mm-hmm. Appreciate that. Hey, let's go down to the farm for a little bit. We knew that there'd be some good things going on in the minor leagues this year. Thank goodness the minor leagues are back after obviously a year off last season. The big names in the system are doing big things early on. Julio Rodriguez was just homering at will at Everett. He's in high A ball this year. Tell us what is going on with Julio Rodriguez right now.
A lot is going on with Julio. First, you know, he's off to an awesome start. I think he is one of the four youngest players at that level in baseball, which is remarkable. And I also think he's one of the five best hitters in terms of statistical achievement to this point in the season. And as we, you know, get into this last week in May, that is to say, he was the best hitter until about a two-day slump in an early season. He's managing the strike zone the way we want to see him manage it. He's hitting not just homers, but long homers, like no-doubter homers. And it took a day or two for him to get in his season. The thing I'm most encouraged about with Julio is that, like happens with Julio when he's going good, it's a couple of line drives to right center field, and then he gets locked in. And he's really been like that whole Everett lineup, up and down the lineup. They've been terrific, but you know Julio has stood out because the talent and the personality precede the results. And now the results, you know, 1,000-ish OPS at his age at that level is kind of remarkable. And he's now going to go off and represent his country, Dominican Republic, in the Olympic qualifier. And yeah, I'll forever root for Julio. I'm gonna keep my fingers crossed that he gets back quickly and in one piece. But we've got, I think, 8 or 9 of our minor leaguers gonna take part in these Olympic qualifiers and/or the Olympics. But you know, excited to see what he will do on the big stage because this is what Julio's built for, is to excel in these moments.
I've been super impressed. The production is obvious. He's been ridiculous. But it's easy to forget, one, you point out his age. He's so young for that level. But also, you know, because of circumstances and some injury along the way, he just hasn't played that much against competition like this. And to see him excel right off the bat, I find pretty amazing.
That was my favorite part of the second half of spring training for Julio. And you know, if I think back to the day that we sent Julio to the minor leagues, that we told him he was going back to start in the minors, and I may have shared this with you.
I think you publicly shared it. You have to. Yeah. It's terrific.
Yeah, you know, he sat down on the couch in Scott's office and spread his arms on the back wings, and you know, we told him that he was going to go back to the minor leagues, that he wasn't going to make the major league team. And he laughed. He said, "I didn't think I was going to make the team." But you know, meanwhile, he was rolling about 1,000 OPS in spring training against major league pitching. And why I say that is because in the first half of major league spring training, that was not the case. You know, he was struggling. It was a lot of strikeouts. He was not hitting the ball as hard as we've seen Julio hit it. And I asked him, "What did you do to make that adjustment?" And he said, "I slowed it down." You know, and that is for someone so young to make that observation. He said, "I just slowed it down. I thought to myself, I have to slow down." And he did, and he just took over. And I don't know that we have a more talented player in the batter's box, just the ability to hit to all fields, the power. You know, he's among the most talented in all the minor leagues in those regards. And now if you add the ability to mentally slow the game down or psychologically slow the game down, those are powerful weapons.
Yeah, can you tell us, I know you're not Julio, but can you take us inside of his mind a little bit? Because we hear this from hitters, right, often, that to slow things down. What exactly does that mean? Because it's obviously a difficult thing to do.
So I think you saw it from Jared Kelenic, the first game in the Oakland series. There's the first at bat against Frankie Montas, when you're seeing 96, 97, 98 miles an hour at all different elevations in the strike zone, you're seeing what I think is a very nasty split changeup that's you will name on some occasion. But when you're seeing those types of weapons and you just force yourself to breathe, and you can see it in Jared's face. You know, the week prior, you're up there and you can see the chest going up and, you know, heaving up and down. You can see the mouth open and there's some anxiety. It's when the hitter is in there and you can see that, you know, he's got the wiggle, he's got the shake, he's breathing comfortably. Julio's doing that in spring training, and he just stepped out and thought to myself, I've got to slow this down. If truth be told, you know, I've never experienced that in the batter's box. It always was very fast to me, you know. But the rare times that I was there. But you have to learn how to do that same thing on the pitcher's mound. And sometimes you need a trigger. You just need a trigger. And for some, you know, if I look at Kyle Seager, you know, Kyle Seager has a knack for you know, opening the mouth.
He does the mouth thing.
There is that's a trigger. You know, I did the same thing as a pitcher. You know, you're looking for a trigger. And I took a stress management course in college, and I was told that you need a trigger, something to calm your face, to calm your nerves in a moment. And each person does something a little different. And, you know, for some, maybe it's easy. Maybe Junior never needed anything like that. You know, the rest of us might. And, you know, and I'm certain that JK, that Julio, that others, they have their own go-to in order to trigger that. And when you're able to do that at the major league level, now you can start having the same, you know, let's call it physical experience that you did when you were in little league or high school or, you know, at college, when you were dominating the, you know, like-aged competition. You're no longer anxious, and you can just cool it down no matter how many people are watching.
For some reason, and I'm guessing it's probably because nobody had ever seen him play on U.S. soil, for some reason, Noelvi Marte, I feel it kind of gets lost in the Mariners prospect shuffle, which in some ways says a lot about Mariners prospects and the depth of them. But Noelvi Marte is now playing on U.S. soil competitively, not at summer camp or the alt site. He's with Low A Modesto right now. He is one of the youngest players in that league as well, and is becoming quickly one of the best players in that league. Tell us about Noelvi Marte.
You know, our system has generated a lot of acclaim over the last couple of years, especially the last year and a half. We have, and if we're talking about the two players, or even the three, you know, with Logan Gilbert, with Julio Rodriguez, with Jared Kelenic, and others, some have been very celebrated for their prospect status, what they've accomplished, all very well deserved. And throughout, when we are talking to the various people who put together these prospect lists, you know, we have oftentimes suggested, hey, don't sleep on Noelvi Marte. He's just as good as the others. The tool set is amazing. The first time you see him, he's got a great look. He's a good looking kid with a beautiful smile, and he's an incredible athlete on a baseball field. You know, he reminds me a lot of the young Hanley Ramirez when Hanley was coming up with the Red Sox, moves on to the Marlins. The shortstop, the speed, the power, and I could gush, and it's deserved. He's got that kind of skill set. And the fact that we're seeing it now at an advanced level, I think he's the second youngest player at that level in baseball. And the fact that he's doing this with less than 400, you know, professional plate appearances.
Like 2 years ago?
Yeah. And you have to remember with Noelvi, and this is true of you know, where Julio was 3 years ago. When the kids are coming out of the Dominican Republic and the programs that we run down in the DR, and they get a season in DSL or two seasons in the DSL, oftentimes that's the first time they've ever really played organized baseball games. You know, more often what they're doing is they're training, you know, for the opportunity to sign a professional contract, where it's a lot of batting practice, a lot of strength training, a lot of infield drills. They're refining their tools, but they don't really get a great deal of exposure to competition. And, you know, the value that we're getting right now out of having Nuelve and Julio playing at these advanced levels at their ages, and they're nailing it, is so exciting. Because, you know, maybe we talk about the jump from, you know, double A, it used to be referred to, the big jump is going from A to double A, you know. And my general thought was, you're all crazy. The big jump is going to the big leagues. I mean, that is the big jump. But if, you know, through all these years, at least the last 20 or so, since I've been operating, you know, in the world that I'm in now, that if truth be told, the biggest jump might be from the DSL to a domestic U.S. league. Because not only are those young players making a hop in competition that is considerably greater than anything they've seen so far, they're doing it and competing, you know, in this way for the first time in their lives while they're going into – well, let's call it social disruption in their life. You know, speaking a second language, doing it in a new country where the customs might be different, food is different. There's so much change for those young players. That might be the only thing comparable to that final jump to the big leagues. And the fact that both of these players seem to have made it so seamlessly is very exciting.
How important is the things you do at the academy for those players outside of baseball to help them get ready for that big jump that you reference?
Probably the most important thing we do, truly. Yeah. You know, we have maybe our two MVPs in international player development are Walkeria Torres and Rene Gallegos, who run our educational programs. And not only are we working on second language, you know, English as a second language, we're working on finishing, you know, a lot of our players wind up getting, I would say now the vast majority of our players wind up getting GEDs before, you know, they graduate the academy or shortly thereafter. And in all cases, you know, both of these ladies provide life skills to our players that they couldn't otherwise get. And I think that's I know in Noelve's case and Julio's case, they come from wonderful families. They're both bright young guys, but to have had the access to the educational programs that our people have really developed over the course of these last half dozen years is credit to the group and credit to really to the Mariners for having the desire to make sure that that we are helping these players develop completely rather than just helping them hit for better power or run faster. You know?
Gary, you heard everything that Jerry said initially on Marte, right?
He sounds 80 grade in your
He's a billboard guy, Gary.
In the Aaron Goldsmith scouting system, he's 80 grade.
Well, I'm just going to, you know, all I can say is that Jerry, there was a lot of directions he could have gone, right? A lot of directions. And he went right to the Goldsmith Scouting School.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Looks good to me.
Looks good to me. Okay.
I actually said to him the day that I met him, we were in a weight room when I met him for the first time. And I said, one day I want to have a poster of you on my wall.
There it is.
He looks like that.
And he has filled out a ton, hasn't he?
Yeah. I mean he's actually grown. Yeah.
Yeah.
Taller. And same with Julio. They're big guys.
See, Jerry. I feel like Jerry probably knew all these things, how to go about building a baseball team.
Uh-huh.
But I do feel like Wheelhouse Time has just slightly
just
reinforced.
Incorporating the Goldsmith model
exactly.
Into some. Yeah,
like
that's a great idea.
It's more intertwined with the fabric of the organization.
Yes.
I guess would be the modest way of putting it.
Very modest.
Yeah, I think it's good. Yeah. That's good. Can I see him on a billboard? Absolutely. He's mine. I'll draft him. I'll sign him. There we go. Whatever he needs.
So my first general manager as a major leaguer was John Hart with the Cleveland Indians. And, you know, long, very successful career as a GM in the game and, you know, later president of baseball ops. But, you know, John used to have a way about him. You know, he'd always tap his chest when he was talking to you. And he would look as soon as you walked in the room, you know, you're a guy. You look like a guy. You got the look. You're a guy, and that's the way he would reference the players. And it seems, you know, a little bit quirky, but you would walk out of that room feeling like you hung the moon. Like you're a guy.
I make people feel great, Jerry.
You told me I'm a guy. I must be a guy.
That's right. Now there are flaws to the Goldsmith scouting.
What?
Scale. There are flaws, but there are flaws to every scouting.
You don't
scale.
Say. There,
yeah. I mean, I do feel like I'm on a probably. An 80% hit rate, which
oh my gosh!
I mean, that's the studies. That's just the feedback that I get.
Okay. Yeah, I'm thinking you're doing the wrong job. We pay handsomely for this.
80%. I mean, you're winning the lottery with my scouting scale, right? Gary is coming around on it. He really is. He had a breakthrough moment recently where he actually said, I think publicly, what was it exactly, Aaron? It's foolproof or it's perfect or something like that.
Foolproof and perfect. Yes.
These seem like
that. Yeah, for sure. You did not make that up at all.
No, I didn't.
That is
no.
The
truth. He gets it. He gets it. And the good thing is, Jerry, you got a lot of billboard guys.
We do have some billboard guys.
Quite a few. High percentage, I would say. Are you ready? I want to make you feel good. Are you ready for Stump JD?
I think.
This is it's unfair for you to answer it fully. Gary and I had a production meeting about this. We don't think it's possible. Because here's the question. Jerry, in the history of Major League Baseball, there have been 5 players to hit a walk-off home run to complete the cycle.
I've got nothing.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. To go 5 for 5, nobody can do that. All right.
I don't think I can go 1 for 5.
Oh, come on now. The last guy to do it was in 17. I'm gonna give you a hint. All I'm looking for is the last 2. All right, 2010, 2017, both play for the same team, and both were like dudes in their franchise's history.
And hit walk-off home runs to complete the cycle.
Now think about what ballpark is most conducive to cycles. Like, what ballpark do we see the most cycles in? I don't know why I'm closing my eyes. That was unnecessary.
You're the one on the hot seat. You're seeing it. I'm going to let the hot seat burn me on this one and say this is – I've got nothing.
It's a park you're familiar with.
Yeah, nothing is coming. Thank you, Gary.
Coors Field.
Yes.
Yeah. I've seen my fair share of cycles at Coors Field, and I don't remember any of them ending in a walk-off homer. Maybe because I'm so excited when the walk-off homer happens that I forget the cycle existed.
You don't even realize. Okay. I'm going to call this.
I see. This one's too hard, man. Yeah, you've gone as far as you can go.
Out before even attempting a guess before.
Because this one would just be wild guessing on my part. This is you gave me a crazy one about Stan Musial years ago.
Pardon me, sir. Nothing is crazy about Stan Musial.
There was some oddity in the question that you provided. But I feel like I'm lost.
We've ratcheted up the difficulty kind of progressively as the wheelhouse has gone.
Hey, man, when he starts spraying doubles into the gap and then hitting him over the fence on questions that we think he's got no chance on.
Yeah.
Right now, I feel like the pilot in Airplane. Like, this is I've got nothing for you.
We're Mitch Haniger in the offseason just scooting up on the pitching machine. Until,
we got a velo machine 20 feet from you right now. High fastballs.
I'm going to miss.
All right. What do you think? Should we just walk them through the 5?
Yeah.
Since this is just a complete disappointment. Okay, first guy to do it, Ken Boyer, 1961.
I wouldn't have gotten Ken Boyer.
Oh, yeah, I understand that. Cesar Tovar. 1972.
Super you.
Dwight Evans in 84.
Dewey.
Tell those tip of your tongue. Okay, now the two guys that I was hoping for, you know, just a shot in the dark. Cargo, a former Mariner.
Yeah, yeah.
In 2010.
Had Cargo on multiple occasions.
So Cargo did it in 2010, and the most recent was in 2017, Nolan Arenado.
Wow.
Walk-off home run to complete the cycle.
So if I would have just taken a moment to focus on Coors Field and pick the best player from the 17 and 10
I'm not going to tell you to give yourself a physical cue to slow it down, Jerry.
This would have been
just
it.
Just slow it
I
down.
I panicked. I got high anxiety.
Slow it down, Jerry.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I don't know. There's this mixed emotion thing. It's like, you know, it's like when you beat your kid in basketball, you know, and
you can take satisfaction in it.
You're 3 feet taller than him. I mean, I did feel like this was a slightly unfair question, but you did this to yourself, man. Like, after you nailed Final Fours and World Series, that whole thing, it was ridiculous, and you got
that was absurd.
Yeah, like, I'm bringing the heat. Sorry, man. we'll ratchet it back down next time.
What else is Cesar Tovar known for?
I don't know. Tell me.
I believe for baseball history, until it very recently became something that people were shooting for, there were 2 players that played all 9 positions in a single game.
Oh, he was one of them?
One being Cesar Tovar, the other being Bert Campanaris, I believe. And
a former Mariner did it.
Well, now it's a thing. Now
it becomes a thing.
Yeah. Now, even in the minor leagues, at least once a year, somebody is going to. But those are manufactured. These were actually, you know, they weren't planned.
Okay.
They were just moving them around the field through necessity.
All right.
Now players are just scheduling it, one inning a position.
You know what, Jerry? I'm going to ask you that question next time on Smart JD. Just to kind of
make me feel better.
Just a little. Little alley-oop, you know?
So you know what I feel like? Almost like you're Apollo Creed just holding my forehead. You know? I'm trying to swing. I can't get anything. Yeah.
We will get to today's listener question. Hey, Brian chimes in on Twitter. He's got a good question, and it's something that's kind of in the topic of conversation this year in baseball. Do you think that last year's shortened season, and for minor leaguers, of course, no season, is the culprit for just a league-wide early rash of injuries? The Mariners are certainly a part of that, but we're seeing it across all of baseball.
I think it's certainly a contributor, you know, especially with the pitchers. And, you know, we talked about this all off-season long, whether it be on the Wheelhouse, you know, various other, you know, public forums. That was a concern of ours, were how we were going to ramp the workload back up for our pitchers. And I know it's been hotly contested. That was the reason why we opted to go with the six-man rotation. It was to try to manage this for our pitchers. It is why the league has allowed us to carry more than 13 pitchers on a staff, to make sure that we were at position to not put anybody in a dangerous position. I do think that while it was strategically an adjustment for us, this is an area where, you know, the reliever or any pitcher having to face a minimum of three hitters has really been helpful because you're forced to not use pitchers so quickly. And you know, it's that much we were expecting. And it's been even more to manage than we thought it would be. But, you know, from a league-wide perspective, this is something that doesn't take anybody by surprise. It's just happening at a greater pace than maybe we or even the players would have assumed. A little less, easy to point toward the rash of injuries with position players. Although I will say that, you know, publicly, like what we're doing, you know, as a society, we no longer have access to the same types of facilities and activities that we always had access to. You know, even the most elite level athletes had to have adjusted their workout routines and their training plans. You know, we didn't really change anything in that regard, but maybe there's something about what's happened over these last 13 or 14 months that changed their routines. It's the only thing I can come up with because it has been hard to manage. You know, that's where we started. It's, you know, when you've got 20 players on the IL, it's really difficult to get through games. But, you know, it's not something that we are dealing with alone. We just happen to be, you know, the flavor of the month this month. But all teams have been battling this for the last 2 months.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Hey, to follow up, I mentioned that a former Mariner played all nine, not as a Mariner, but Andrew Romine played all nine with the Tigers. And Gary and I will always remember Andrew Romine because it was a day game at Coors Field, and we're walking to the ballpark, and Andrew Romine is also walking to the ballpark. And we
briefcase in hand.
Yes, he did. Perfect. How did you know
leather
that?
Leather attaché.
He had like actual, like there was like a conference that he was going
to. Yeah, glasses on, like the whole thing. He's going.
But that proves the point even greater, I think. Andrew Romine, Gary and I look like nothing.
That's accurate.
We blend.
You've outraged Gary.
Yeah, I mean, we blend. We don't look like athletes. We, you know, like Nelson Cruz next to us, like one is an athlete, one is a normal human being, right? On the scale of major leaguers that we would have a chance shoulder to shoulder to like kind of look like, it's Andrew Romine.
Romy's going to be up there. Yeah.
He's... You know, like he's better put together, obviously, but there isn't this night and day contrast between Gary, me, and Romine. So Romine walks in front of us with attaché in hand to go through the security gate at Coors Field hours before the game. And he has glasses on, luggage. He looks like one of us. And they just let him go right through. Just come on in. You're clearly a player. And what happens to us, Gary?
Oh, we're not going right on through. That's for sure.
I mean, The metal detector, take it out of your pockets.
Open your bags.
Sniffing dogs, the metal wands. I mean, we had to prove multiple layers of verification of our identity. I mean, it was like a 30-minute process. And Romine just strolls right through. So just, when we think of Andrew Romine, I think forever, that's what we will think of. Yeah.
Is that the day that he actually played all of the...
If it was the day, we could have played all nine.
Yeah, is it Romy? I will say this, that having seen him play since college, he's one of those wiry athletic guys. Like, there was a time,
yeah,
on the 80 scale, there was a time, you know, Andrew Romine at one point was like a 70 runner. He could fly, you know, a super athletic guy who looks unassuming when carrying the brown leather. It's but he was, I think he was the last of the major league players. He was the dinosaur. And, you know, in the era I played in, I bet 50% of the players, when you went on a road trip, carried a leather briefcase. Don't ask, right?
I have asked.
I was not one of them. but Andrew Romine was the last of the leather briefcase toters, by my observation. I once asked a teammate, you know, come on, what's in there? Opened it up. It's like toothpaste and a toothbrush. It's the things he didn't want to put in his luggage and he just carried them. There, it's not like there's, you know, NASA secret,
right,
you know,
launch codes,
rocket science,
secret scouting reports. Yeah. All right. Well, Romine, great guy, fantastic guy.
Couldn't
we love being around him. We didn't love it when he just flew through there, but good for him. He deserves it. You know, he's a big leaguer, for goodness sakes. Jerry, I feel like we've covered a lot of ground. Per usual, most of it that we brought to the table was highly unnecessary. We appreciate you playing along, and thank you for the insights on the ball club as always.
Now, hopefully, like I said, hopefully we get into June and we start recovering and doing the things that we know we can do.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.